would like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She is a storyteller. She speaks all over the world on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
So today we're talking about the opera Arabella by Richard Strauss.
Mm.
Excuse my German pronunciation.
Yeah, that's very good. You do it again.
Richard Strauss.
You see, great.
And Ugo von Hofmannsthal is the librettist, right?
Is that German mother that does it, right?
Every time.
Well, this is one of Strauss's great operas. He had an amazing career, and again, against a background of wartime Vienna. And this opera is focused on Vienna, actually. Vienna, the glorious city, which was at the height of its magnificence when they wrote the opera Der Rosenkavalier. They wrote about that particular time. Their operatic career for Strauss and von Hofmannsthal is sort of interesting. They started with Salome and Elektra, which are wildly expressionistic operas. They were very difficult operas. But then they sort of drew back with Der Rosenkavalier, which was the third opera. This was sort of in a neoclassical, almost Mozartian style, complete with the Knight of the Gold, the Silver Rose, the Young Cavalier, sung by a mezzo-soprano, a panzero. so that was a great piece. And then he did a number of other operas. And then comes to Arabella. He had just finished composing the Egyptian Helena, and he wrote to von Hofmannsthal, his good friend. Hofmannsthal was a poet, first and foremost. He was an intellectual, whereas Strauss was much more a man of the theater. They came from different backgrounds and places, but their collaboration was very interesting. So at this point, Strauss writes to von Hofmannsthal saying, I don't have anything to do right now. I'm bored. I want to keep my hand in. Can you throw something together? Which sort of totally insulted von Hofmannsthal. I said, I just can't throw something together for you. It doesn't work that way, and it would be a disaster. So that's where it started out, and Strauss is searching. Half of the lives of these composers seems to be searching for the right libretti.
It's interesting that they had such different styles of working, and they worked together for so long with such deep mutual respect.
Yeah,
and yet
they had
such different kind of styles and ways of thinking and ways of composing.
Yeah, they came from very different places, the two men. They didn't meet that often, so which is great for
which
us.
Which probably helped.
Maybe it did, but it also means that we have the letters, so we know what happened. I mean, today, trying to track the compositional process of a new opera is a nightmare because it's all done on email, which are probably discarded and nobody keeps. I mean, people used to keep letters so you could track this process. I think the creative process of how these operas come into being is really interesting. So anyway, von Hofmannsthal put his thinking cap on, and he searched amongst his various sources and came up with a play that he had actually thought of doing some years earlier about a family in Vienna who was short of money. Their money had run out, and they have to marry one of their two daughters off to an eligible suitor.
It sounds like a Jane Austen novel.
It is a bit, I suppose. Set in Vienna.
Set in Vienna, sort of fading aristocracy.
Yes, exactly.
Who
they
lost
are.
Their money.
Yes, they are. I mean, they've rented this apartment in a glamorous hotel on the Ringstrasse for the season, hoping that Arabella will land a good husband. But they're really out of money. In fact, when the Count Waldner requests a glass of brandy, the waiter comes to the door and says, we've been told not to give you any more, no more service to this room because they're not paying their bills. It's that bad. Anyway, they start working on this, and it took Strauss a little while to get excited about the piece. He thought maybe Mandrika was going to be the central character, and then he wanted Arabella to be the center, but he wasn't getting very excited about Arabella's character. He felt she was a little thin. So they went through a lot of trial and error, I suppose, trying different ways of bringing Arabella to life. And then it all fell into place, as these things do. And von Hofmannsthal came up with the idea of writing a piece for her called Albert der Richtige, When I Find the Right Man. And that suddenly gave shape and form to her character, which Strauss was able to work with.
And that puts her in the position of having to decide, potentially puts her in the position of having to decide whether she's going to go off with some aristocrat who's going to bring money back into the family, mm-hmm. or follow her heart. But of course, in the beginning, she hasn't met anybody. But you know, it's der Richtige, the right one, reminds me of so many, like the song. Someday he'll come along, the man I love, or the one
musicals.
From musical, the Guys and Dolls. I'll know when my love comes along. It's really the same exact theme.
Maybe it's the dream of many young girls, you know, before you start dating and you're looking for the right person, and you know, you hope and daydream, how will he be, the one I love, you know, the man I love. Or it's in many.
I don't think it stops at the age of 18. Either.
No, maybe not.
If you look at all the people who were trying to find the right person at every age.
Right.
It goes on and on.
Well, this play lent itself to opera because the second act is a Viennese ball scene. And at the ball, Arabella has three very eligible suitors, none of whom she really likes. Strauss calls them in a letter to Hofmannsthal the three nincompoops because their attitude is she wants to talk in depth about subjects. And one of them says to her, oh, don't bother about that. Just live for the moment, which was sort of how people were living in Vienna in the 1860s. The end of the great Habsburg Empire was beginning to unravel and come undone. And this is the result. There's a massive change in society.
Kind of a decadent period.
Yeah, it's a decadent period. So she sings this lovely aria. Near the beginning, she's with her sister. Now, this is about a family. Count Waldner, who is an inveterate gambler, who loves his family in his way, but he's much more interested in gambling. His wife, Adelaide, who's a bit of an airhead, and she gambles too, in a sense. She has a fortune teller who tells her and us the plot of the opera, what's going to happen in the very opening moments. And then the two daughters, the gorgeous Arabella, who has got to find a husband, and then Zdenka. Now, Zdenka is an interesting young woman because she's dressed as a man throughout the opera, through most of it, because the family cannot afford to launch two daughters in Viennese society. So she's dressed as a boy, and her mother rationalizes. She says, well, it's no big deal. She was always a tomboy. She's happy dressing like this. So it didn't
cost
them.
Which we're not really sure if she is.
No, of course. And that unravels the plot, and there's a mistake, obviously a big tragic flaw mistake. But at this point, the two sisters are together. Arabella and Zdenka, her sister, are very close. And Arabella sings Aber der Richtige, the one who's right for me, if there is one for me in all this world, will stand before me all at once, his eyes on mine, mine on him, and no more doubting will remain, no more asking, happy I shall be. I mean, it's very romantic and very waltz-like. So let's hear some of this, the aria. And this is sung on this recording by Hilda Gooden, who was one of the great Arabellas. And that is Arabella from Richard Strauss's Arabella. The recording we're listening to today is the Vienna Philharmonic with George Shorty conducting. Hilda Gooden is the Arabella and Waldemar Kement is Mandrika.
It's interesting to talk at this point, and we've talked about this in past years when we've been talking about opera, is typecasting versus casting for the best voice. And, of course, they try to do both, but with Arabella, I certainly hope for a kind of sweet young flower of an opera singer.
Mm-hmm. Though our performer in this role is absolutely gorgeous. She's younger. Kiriti Kanawa, I think, was the singer who absolutely looked the part. I mean, she was never... Well, Arabella's probably in her mid-20s. She's not 15, as some of these women are supposed to be, youngsters. So Kiriti Kanawa absolutely looked the part. She was quite lovely. Erin Wall will be singing our Arabella. She sang Daphne here a few years ago, I think that would be lovely. So then we meet the right man, Mandrika, who is quite a character.
Mr. Wright comes
along. Mr. Wright, he does. Absolutely. The minute she finishes her aria, so to speak, has to happen quickly in opera. There's not an awful lot of time. And, of course, she recognizes him. She's actually noticed a stranger standing outside in the street, and she wonders who is that, and her feelings tell her this might be the one.
And they look into each other's eyes.
They do, but they don't do that till the second act. First of all, there's this marvelous scene with her father. The father has sent off her portrait to an old army friend in Croatia. And in those days, Croatia was a very long way from Vienna. Now, not so far. And there's a knock on the door, and Mandrika is announced. And the father's somewhat taken back. This is a young man, not the old army friend he'd expected. He was quite happy to marry his daughter off to an old army friend in Croatia. But what happens is this younger man shows up, and he explains that his uncle had died, the portrait came to him, and that he fell in love with the portrait, and he is here to ask for her hand in marriage. So there's a wonderful scene here. Can I read a little bit of what he says? He says, "That was my uncle. He is dead. I am now the last Mandrika. I hope you will forgive my being bold enough to read the note you sent. All must depend on that." And he shows the picture. And then he goes on to say what had happened to him and why he had not come the minute he got the letter. He said... He brings the letter out, the portrait and the letter, and there's sort of blood stains on it. And he tells the father, "You see, there are some blood stains on it that make it hard to read. That very day they brought me my letter. I was out hunting, chasing a she-bear. She took me on for battle and embraced me. She scratched me and cracked my ribs." They didn't use the word cracked, whatever it is. "Broke my ribs, and for 12 weeks I was lying in bed recovering, but gazing at the portrait of your daughter whom I want to marry." So he sounds marvelous, this Mandrika. Is quite a character.
Yeah, getting into love fests with bears.
Yeah, well, he's a man of the woods, and it turns out he is totally gauche when it comes to Viennese society. He has absolutely no idea of how to behave in Vienna. And the Viennese treat him as sort of a bit of an oddity, but they're quite happy to take his money and drink his wine, of course. So maybe we should hear a little of that first interview, I suppose, with the father, with Mandrika. And Mandrika is a baritone. This is an interesting opera from Strauss's point of view, because he was never really fascinated by male voices. He loved sopranos. So all of his leading ladies are these fabulous sopranos. And the men are not the strongest characters in his operas, with the exception of this one. This Mandrika is a real man. He's a baritone. And the baritone gets the girl in this opera.
I was going to say, we have talked many times about how the baritone sometimes mostly doesn't get the girl. It's always the tenor.
In this one, he does. But if he's a man from the wild woods and the forests of Croatia, maybe he needs to be a baritone.
Let's hear it.
Der Onkel ist dahin, heut bin ich der Mandrika, niemand sonst. Meinen Augen dieses Bild und mein
Freier Höfen, was uns mit unserem Herr. Kommen wir von den Kohlenhöfen, freut unseren Herr kein Pferd mehr. Kommen meine Förster, freut unseren Herr kein Jagen. Ich geb ihnen keine Antwort, wer kommt, ich hol mir den Juden.
So a lot of verbiage from Mandrika.
Oh, yes, he has a lot to say for himself. He comes in very bombastic and quite a contrast to the sort of superficial lifestyle of Vienna. I mean, I think Strauss must have had great fun doing this. He was 69 years of age when he actually wrote this piece. I mean, he and Hofmannsthal had been working together for 30 years. And there was a sad story. Maybe we should talk about that.
Well,
here.
I was going to say Hofmannsthal died.
Yes, yes.
Before, I mean, he'd basically written it but hadn't revised the second and third act.
That's right.
The
first act had been completed after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, like we talked about, and the second and third act had been written but had not been finally polished. So Hofmannsthal sends everything off to Strauss, who says, congratulations, it looks great. And he sends the telegram back, which is how they communicated in those days. And the telegram arrived on the day that when Hugo von Hofmannsthal was dressing to go to the funeral of his son, who had committed suicide. As he's dressing, he had a massive heart attack, and he died. It was a terrible tragedy, and it really took the ground from underneath Strauss's feet. The men were very close in spite of this. They're different personalities and characters. You know, they had 30 years of incredible work together, and he really mourned him. So he decided that rather than doing all of the fine tuning and cleaning and the to-ing and fro-ing that goes on for months, years sometimes, with these operas, that the first act was just as he wanted it, but he would actually present the second and third acts as Hofmannsthal had left them, as a memorial, a tribute to him, which was it was a sad story in the midst of all this, which was he was having all sorts of difficulties, actually, when it came to production. The conductor that he wanted in the Dresden Opera House to conduct the premiere was Jewish, and Hitler had just been named chancellor, and the Jewish conductor was fired. So Strauss says, I don't want to do my opera here now, but they actually held him to his contract. He didn't have a choice. It had to be done. He didn't have a choice, and Clemens Krauss conducted with great success. But I'd like to play another little bit now from Mandrika, actually, in a very sweet little folksy moment. There's wonderful folk moments come into German composers' music. The Germans walk so much. I think that's part of what it is. So they walk the hills and they're out thinking, walking. Beethoven apparently had his most marvelous inspirations when he was walking the Vienna woods. Wagner listened to the Song of the Birds and wrote the Forest Bird into the Ring. So it's a common German thing, perhaps. So here we have Mandrika, who is, he is now, this is the second act. He has met Arabella, and the two of them are getting to know each other, and they decide that, yes, they are right for each other. And then he tells her a wonderful little story about how people get engaged in his country, and we'll play this. He sings, this very evening at sleeping time, if you were living in a village, one I call my own, you'd go and kneel beside the well that's behind your father's house and draw a drink of water, just one goblet full, for me, who's standing by the threshold. Thus I'd be betrothed to you, and God would be our witness, lovely Arabella.
Zeit wirst du ein Mädchen aus den Dörfern, eine Meinigen. Du müsstest mir zum Brunnen gehen, hinter deines Vaters Haus, und klares Wasser schöpfen, einen Becher voll.
And we're listening to music from Arabella by Richard Strauss, and we're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. And we are back with Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, talking about the opera Arabella. And so where are we in the plot? So this nice gentleman caller who likes to wrestle with bears and...
Has shown up and Arabella gets it. This is the right man.
And they look into each other's eyes finally and the yes, and the chemistry is there. And what happens next? Do you think it's going to just be, well, they... lift a glass together and live happily ever after.
No, it's the second act. It has to
but
be a three.
No.
Now the plot comes unraveled. But before that, there's a fun scene here at the fiacre ball. A fiacre is the small horse-drawn carriage that you can still actually ride around Vienna in. That's how people got about. And once a year in Vienna on Shrove Tuesday, at the end, the beginning of Lent, in those times, Carnival happened in January and February. And then at the beginning of Lent, everything had to stop. You couldn't the opera houses were closed. Everything was closed until Easter. That was the tradition. So the tradition here with the fiacre ball is that the cabmen who drove these fiacres would bring their wives and girlfriends and daughters, the whole families, all dressed up to the nines, and they would party, typically with the aristocratic men of the time who were all dressed up and flirted and drank too much champagne. It was wild. Strauss took a little artistic license with this, in that in those real balls, no women, aristocratic women, would go. The wives and daughters had to stay home. But here, Arabella is to be feted as the queen of the ball. And the fiacre millies were the characters at the center of this, the daughters. And in this in opera, fiacre millie sings this slightly outrageous yodeling aria that everybody, you know, condemned at the time.
We're going to listen to a yodeling aria.
That was exactly the reaction of the critics at the time.
We won't subject you to it, ladies and gentlemen, for too long.
No, it's about a minute 22. It's actually quite fun, but it's a showy piece, a real coloratura of leaps and bounds of the fiacre millies. It was said of the fiacre millies, they were great sisters because they couldn't say no to any man. So here it is, fiacre millie.
Sound like yodeling?
Well, it's operatic yodeling. This is opera. You have to give it a little license. You did bring something up, though, Mary Charlotte, as we were listening to this, is how the excerpt before, the beautiful strings in this piece.
Yes. I mean, this is something to listen for. There are books. My mother has this wonderful book called A Night at the Opera, in which the author summarizes the operas and then tells you what to look for musically in each section.
Yes.
And in this one, listen to how the strings, the violins and so on accompany the voice.
Yes, there's beautiful, lush instrumentation. In fact, I think with Strauss very often you have to try not to listen to the voice in order to listen to the music, because it's always very beautiful. And this is, in a sense, it's a Viennese waltz opera, so there's lots of strings and lots of waltzes, as we heard there. This was sort of a bit of an aberration, but I think Strauss was having fun. At 69, you can probably afford to do that. So anyway, at this point then, this is the light entertainment at the Fiacre Ball, and things get serious because the Denka comes in and she's dressed as a man, as a young man, of course, but it is a woman, which is sort of confusing in terms of gender here.
Now, don't forget, this is Arabella's sister.
Yep, dressed as a man.
Who's dressed as a man because her parents can't afford to present two women to society. I love that.
Yeah, exactly. But she's actually, it is a woman pretending to be dressed as a man. It's one of those cross-gender things.
But it's played by a woman.
Played by a woman. Opera does it all the time. So she comes on and she approaches Matteo, the officer. Now, Matteo is passionately in love with Arabella, but Arabella doesn't have any time for him. She's not interested. But nevertheless, Matteo is receiving these passionate love letters from Arabella. What has been happening is that Zdenka is all girl, and underneath the male tomboy exterior, she is in love with Matteo. So she has been writing letters to Matteo, love letters, but signing them with Arabella's name. So now she comes to him. The two boys are commiserating. Zdenka is a boy, and Matteo saying, she pays no attention to me. She won't even look at me. And Zdenka says, don't worry. Here is the key to her room, and she'll meet you there in a short space of time. So he goes.
So he's playing the dude.
Yeah, he is.
I mean, she's playing the dude.
She's playing the dude, yeah. So he goes bouncing off all happy. Finally, he's going to have an assignation in a bedroom with Arabella. But who overhears this conversation but Mandrika? And Mandrika assumes the worst. She's going to have this night out or night in on the night of their betrothal. And he's absolutely furious. And it's made worse when Arabella comes in and says, well, I've said goodbye to my three counts, the three suitors, and I'm a little tired. I'm going back to the hotel early. So he's convinced that the worst is happening. So he proceeds to get very drunk, drinks too much champagne, and the parents are mortified at this point. Their new son-in-law, who owns all these forests and vast lands in Croatia, may be escaping them. So they all decide they'll go back to the hotel. The final act then opens in the hotel where Arabella has gone back early, and she's sitting in the lobby sort of reminiscing how much she loves Mandrika. And at the top of the stairs, a door opens and Matteo comes out of a bedroom. He looks over the edge of the banisters and he sees her sitting below, and he's absolutely flummoxed. He says, how can this be? I just left her in the bedroom and here she is downstairs. He didn't know he had been making love to Zdenka. Silly man. However, at this point, the rest of everybody else shows up. The Mandrika, who's furious, the parents, and half of the people at the ball who get wind of this drama. They show up in the hotel, and the whole thing is beginning to fall apart. Mandrika confronts Arabella, you've been unfaithful, what's going on? I break off the engagement, and the father says, I challenge you to a duel, and things are going downhill rapidly when the door at the top of the stairs opens again, and a young woman in a nightdress with flowing hair comes flying down the stairs, and she sings, Mama, Papa, I'm on my way to the river to drown myself for shame. I just spend the night in the arms of Matteo, who stands there with an appropriate look of shock on his face. You can imagine. So it really ratchets up to this crazy climax of total frustration. Arabella is very gentle with her sister, takes her under her arm and tries to comfort her.
Well, the thing that's nice about Arabella's character is she remains completely calm through this whole thing.
She does.
And says, Mandrika, look, what are you talking about?
Yeah, you don't trust me?
You don't trust me?
You've only known me 6 hours. We're getting married. You don't trust me? So she says, maybe he's not the right man. She actually says that at one point.
Right.
This offer can be looked at in actually quite a humorous vein. It's not to be taken too seriously.
I should hope not.
No. So the whole thing unravels then, and everything is resolved, and it's made clear what's happened. And Mandrika is now the one who is shamed because he has not trusted Arabella. And it's clear that Zdenko was with Matteo, and those two get betrothed. And then the opera comes to the final magnificent moments. This opera leads up to this final scene, which is so beautiful. Arabella says, we've had enough excitement for the night. Why doesn't everybody go home or go to bed? And she starts going up the stairs, and she turns to Mandrika and she says, can you ask your manservant to bring me a glass of water? Which he does, and she goes up to her room, and Mandrika's pacing the floor. You know, he's he's kicking himself. I've ruined it. I've lost her, and I'm a fool, and all the appropriate
things. I should
have
trusted her. What was I thinking?
All of those good things that you get in musicals as well, of course. And then at the last moment of the opera, the door at the top of the stairs opens again, and Arabella appears at the top with a glass of water in her hands, and she comes slowly down the staircase singing this absolutely stunningly beautiful aria. When she gets to the bottom, she hands him the glass, and he gets the symbolism. He drinks the glass, smashes it, and takes her in his arms as the opera ends. So
aww,
it's a happy ending opera.
We like those.
We like happy endings. So maybe we could play a little of the final aria, which is the great piece at the end. If we have time for that, maybe let's play some of that.
Was Arabella's final aria in Arabella by Richard Strauss.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful piece, this. It's you leave the theater feeling good about life, love, and oneself, hopefully. So the music is beautiful.
Desiree, who's going to be composing? I mean, who's going to be conducting and directing this opera? And tell us a little bit about the singers.
We have the wonderful Sir Andrew Davis, who is a Brit, who is a resident conductor at the Chicago Lyric Opera at the moment. He will be conducting this. He absolutely loves this piece. In fact, I should tell people, too, that if you go online to santafeopera.org, there are online interviews, visuals, and discussion with singers, directors, and conductors. That gives you extraordinarily wonderful insights to where these people are coming from in terms of the opera. So if you're still debating about what to see, and I haven't convinced you to see all five, do that. Go online, santafeopera.org, and you'll get to these online interviews with the performers. So Andrew Davis is on there. He talks about why this is one of his favorite operas. Tim Aubrey, who has been here before, will direct. And Erin Wall, as I said, who was our Daphne, sings the key role of Arabella. Mark Delavan, who is one of the leading baritones of our time, sings Mandrika. And Heidi Stober, who's a wonderful, is a singer with great comedic talent, will be perfect as Zdenka. So those are the three leading singers in this piece, with a complete chorus, of course, the three noble nincompoops along with the rest.
Now, let's talk for a moment about the apprentice program. That is a crucial part of the Santa Fe Opera.
And it's also crucial for thousands of young singers. In this day and age where a singer trains as a singer, they must then go out and sing small parts. And I remember when I was a dancer, I used to do summer shows on the end of a pier in Lowestoft off the west coast of England, which is where Peter Benjamin Britten and Peter Grimes were composing. And I didn't know at the time now. But, you know, when I was going to be a serious ballet dancer, I wanted to be a swan, and here I am kicking my legs up on the end of a pier. But it was great experience for getting stage experience. So the apprentices study. They train with a coach, and then they go out and do these small parts. And then when they've had some experience, they apply to apprentice programs at opera houses such as ours. Ours is reputedly one of the best in the country, I understand. Thousands apply for about 40 positions, which is amazing. So we have from the general manager on down, general director, Charles McKay, go and hear. They weed them out first, the people they're sort of looking for, and then they hear many, many singers. So when they come to Santa Fe, these young singers with this on their resume, it's really a great strength. They are used in all of the smaller parts. They sing in the chorus and they work with the great directors. And for two Sundays in the season, there is an apprentice concert. And this is a wonderful opportunity for them because they work with these great directors. The directors of the main stage productions direct. They work with the stage management in costumes. And the whole thing is presented as a ready-to-go act or whatever it is. So for two Sundays, and these are minimally priced, so you can call the box office to go. From the apprentices' point of view, this is a wonderful opportunity because the general directors of other opera companies from all over the world come to Santa Fe that week to listen to these singers. They do the apprentice programs, which is the real live thing, and they also audition. So there's wonderful opportunities. So that's the singers, but there's also a stagehands, stage crew apprentice program where young people learn the craft of working backstage.
Sometimes the apprentices are understudies for major roles.
That's right.
And we've had cases a couple of years ago, a woman that I knew who was a 24-year-old apprentice got put into Falstaff.
That's right.
At the last minute. And the thing is, and you think about the discipline it takes to be an understudy for a role that you may never perform on stage, or at least not anytime soon, not in this production, and yet you have to be ready, even if it's not going to happen.
Yeah, well, that goes with the territory at that stage of your life, you know, and it's a great opportunity. If you ever get to sing it down the road, you've done it.
Yeah.
And this has happened many times here, that occasionally, for instance, a singer may come and sign a contract and then find that they can't breathe at 7,000 feet. You know, that's very real. The altitude can be a problem for some singers, so if they're not going to be able to do it, they have to have someone ready who can step into the role. For the same reason, I understand it's written into their contracts that they're not supposed to leave Santa Fe during the run of their opera, because it's, you know, jet-setting back to Europe to sing a one concert and come back to 7,000 feet plays havoc with your voice.
Right.
And it's tricky. They don't do it too often.
So there's going to be an event, a gala event, on the 4th of August with Susan Graham.
Yes, the wonderful Susan Graham, who is local. She was born in Roswell. That's where she comes from. And she loves being in Santa Fe. She's sung many times for us, and she's singing all the great operas and the great opera houses at the moment. So it's an evening on August the 4th at 8 o'clock, and it's called Susan Graham and Friends. The music will range from Mozart to Gershwin, so it'll be a nice range of music, with the leading singers from our operas this summer and some surprise guests. And apparently,
where is it at?
It's at the Opera House. Yeah,
okay.
It'll be at the Opera House at 8 o'clock. She will sing a Mozart aria and with the piano accompaniment on stage by Frédéric Chazelin, who's a wonderful person, our resident conductor. Champagne will be served to the entire audience before the concert, and a cast party follows. And Susan is very accessible. I took a group to San Francisco a few months ago, and she came out. She sang this amazing role where she was on stage for 3 hours solid, and then we wait at her dressing room, and she comes out and she sees us and she says, "Ah, the New Mexico group," and she sings a song of New Mexico. I couldn't believe she was still singing. She's wonderful. So
now, what, Desiree Mays, have you been doing over the last year since we talked to you?
I've been busy. A lot of the time I spend going to other opera houses in the winter time. Since we have a summer season, I'm here for the entire summer. And then the winter I go to the Metropolitan Opera. In May, I talked on three operas at the Met, which was wonderful. I only had to fly there once for three talks, that's the hard part, getting there and back, especially in the winter. Talked about the Macropolis case of Janáček, about a woman who lives to be 337 years of age. That was wonderful. I call that talk The Curse of Immortality. And the question is, if you could be immortal, would you be? Would you be immortal if you could?
Well, it's a great question, and it's one that becomes more relevant as we understand the functioning of the human body ever better, and people
exactly.
are able to do things that extend. I mean, when you consider the average life expectancy has almost doubled
mm-hmm.
in the last century,
right.
we can only imagine what we're going to understand a century from now. And I actually was having this conversation recently with a friend, and I was thinking about, I mean, immortality. Forget about what my own point of view is about wanting to live forever. But what if lots of people mm-hmm. were able to live 200, 300, 400 years? I mean, the population crisis would be so out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of rules could you make around it? And if somebody said, I want to be immortal, then would you have to tie their tubes or whatever so that they couldn't have any children? And
exactly.
And my friend who I was talking to said, forget about all that. Think about having all these dinosaurs around who were thinking the thoughts of 200 years ago and holding back culture
mm-hmm.
by not getting out of the way for new thoughts and new ideas to emerge.
Yeah, that's a fascinating thought, because actually the answer to the question comes with provisos. You know, at what can I stay at, say, one age, or am I going to grow from 1 to 337? I don't want to do that. And can I end it if I want to? Turns out the character in the opera becomes bored and filled with ennui. Nothing satisfies her.
And all your friends are dead.
Everyone would have to be doing this. And then each of the characters in the play argues for and against it. It's very interesting. And then somebody in my audience at the Met got up and said, well, you know, in a sense, we do live as if we're going to be immortal, because we don't know the date of our death. So we live as if we are going to be here forever, which I thought was an interesting point. It started a wonderful discussion. So that was one. I talked about Billy Budge, which we did here in Santa Fe with such success. And quite honestly, our production, I thought, was much better. It was we had a dynamism. There was an excitement about what we did here that was great. And then one of the great Ring operas on the ending of Götterdämmerung. How did Wagner manage to end this 16-hour epic that it took him 26 years to write? That was interesting, because the Met is just finishing up its controversial Ring cycle at the moment with this enormous set by Robert Lepage, who was the designer of Cirque du Soleil, and who seemed to have taken his skills to the Met without really understanding what the Ring was all about. There's a lot of criticism. So there's a lot of talk about that. So the art form is sort of alive and well, but in my experience and all my travels is that Wagner audiences are different to others. If people go to hear Wagner, they go for these 16 hours, 4 days. They don't want to do anything else but think about it, meditate before it. And it even gets to be difficult how do you eat, because you might go to a Wagner performance at 5 and get out at midnight, and how do you eat? You know, you don't have a large lunch, or you just sleep through it. It's an amazing phenomenon. And actually,
maybe they should have intravenous.
Yeah, IVs at the opera, there, along with the titles on the back of the seat. Now, there's a great idea. There are slow parts of the Ring. It would be great. So, my travels have taken me all over. I talk at Los Angeles. I've just been invited to San Francisco to talk about Moby Dick. Now, this is a new opera, and I'm thrilled about this. They've done this opera without the whale. Can you imagine?
What?
So, well, how do you do it?
I was going to say, is the whale a baritone? Yeah,
you're right. There's no girl in it. But again, the whale becomes that monumental wall that we face at sometimes in our lives of how do we live, how do we deal with this phenomenal issue. It's a great piece. I'm thrilled to be talking about that. And then came back from Spain, where I took a group to Madrid, Valencia, and Barcelona. That was great fun.
So the opera that you see all over the world in the opera houses and people you talk to, I mean, we are in a kind of world economic, if not crisis, let's call it, it is a crisis, and we're having a lot of economic problems all over the world. Opera is a very expensive art form. How's it doing?
It is, and it's very vulnerable. In Italy and Spain, things are disastrous. The theater, the beautiful Lucio Theater in Barcelona, ran out of money, so they closed the theater for the last month of the season, which happened to be the month we were going there, unfortunately. But they just closed it. They had to. They were out of money. In Italy, you never know that the show is going to happen until you actually show up on the day of the show. It's like that. I think there's something to remember here that in Europe, the operas are funded typically by governments. You know, there's massive government funding and support of the arts in Europe that we don't have here. A very small percentage comes from the people and from sponsors. And it's exactly the reverse here. American opera houses are lucky to get any funding from the government right now. Everything has to be raised from the public sector.
The private sector, yes.
People have to support it because I don't know if people realize, but no matter what you pay for your seat, and the seats can be expensive, it only ever covers about 50% of the true cost of what it takes to put on an opera. Though, again, opera houses are bending over backwards to make a good range of prices, so it can be very expensive. But you can get seats for $25 if you book early.
You can get standing room, you can go on family night. There's all sorts of ways to do it. Which I love. I want to thank the Santa Fe Opera for making that possible.
Yeah, no, they work very hard at that, but it's a very fine balance. And even in structuring the season, how do you know how many performances of Tosca versus King Roger or Arabella to put on?
Right.
That's a mathematic equation that's tough, that John Crosby had down.
Now, when you see these places in Europe that are used to government funding, the funding's not there, are they then going to the wealthy people of Spain and Italy
somewhat, but typically it's just not in their psyche. It's not in the culture. Though originally, we have to remember that opera was born into the aristocracy, into private houses,
yeah.
The patronage of the great houses. And then it shifted over to theaters where the people, the public, everybody, you and I could go to the opera, which was the right move. And it's always been supported well by their governments. Another thing to remember, I think, in a time of austerity is that this is a time people need theater. When things are tough and the economy is falling apart and everyone's depressed, theater can take you out of yourself. It can be uplifting. So there's a need for theater, for movies, for drama, for comedy especially, for opera, for concerts. So there is that sort of means of helping people at a time of difficulty, though the cost is always an issue for the production people.
The Santa Fe Opera opens this Friday night, the 29th of June, with Tosca.
It does, yes.
It should be a rousing, great night.
It's always a very festive weekend. People party beforehand in the car parks, and two great shows. And as you mentioned, you know, a young singer who is understudying the role of Tosca at Covent Garden when Angela Gorgiou was sick and couldn't perform, and she stepped into her shoes and became an overnight star. So that will be very exciting for opening night.
And before we go, one more thing I wanted to thank Peter Hull for putting together all the musical excerpts in this opera series.
Yeah, he did a great job. There's a lot of work in that.
A lot of work. And Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering and for being just an absolutely terrific sound engineer. Thank you.
Thank you both.
Desiree, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Marishanda. Another great season.
We've been speaking with Desiree Mays. She is an international speaker on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. The opera season opens on Friday, June 29th. For more information on the Santa Fe Opera, you can go to santafeopera.org. You can call 505-986-5900 or 800-280-4654.